โอระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะอภารุธาเดสังอมตะสัทธาวราเยโสรวันธาบำมุจันทุสะทัง
There's only a few days left of this retreat, as you're well aware, and back into what they call the real world, which is not real. Into the question always arises: how should I practice when I go home? Because, as I pointed out in the beginning, this is a kind of laid-on affair. Where everything is kind of set up, provided. It's an idyllic situation, but it's, you know, it's a It does give you a chance to, say, just live in a rather unique way for a couple of weeks, in which you begin to notice things about yourself and your experience that you probably would not notice so clearly or would overlook in a more ordinary situation. One thing, getting so not talking in the silence and in the stillness and the ordered life that we live during this retreat, then with like a sensory deprivation, the amount of sensory impingement is minimal. So recognize that is one, as if you're not being stimulated in highly by. Through the senses, when you're kind of letting go of just reactivity and of self-obsessions and duties, responsibilities, and all the rest, then you begin to notice the natural state of being in this awareness. And that's very important to see that, to get to know that, because we generally don't notice, we forget, and the real world, quote unquote, is kind of screams and yells and tells us all kinds of things, and all couched in the forms of what we should and shouldn't do or be. But in terms of recognizing what a real refuge is, in that place where there is balance, peace, clarity, stillness, which you're beginning to recognize is through direct experience, not just an idea anymore. Well, how do we maintain that in the day when we go back home and back to the place that we work, where everything, the sensory impingement is so strong. So this is where, how to integrate practice in daily life. In the monastic form, you have an ordered life, basically, set around the morning puja, morning, evening chanting, and the phases of the moon, and the meal, and the robes and the bowl and the things that are monastic. You're using that as references for reflection, composing yourself, establishing mindfulness around the robe or the alms bowl or the food or the every morning, every evening there's a puja, the bowing, the chanting, and so forth, these all help, you know, if used skillfully, if used in the right way, to help us to remember that still point, that collected place of awareness in the present. But we still can, monks are still pretty good at doing all this thing in a perfunctory way. You know, because any convention becomes perfunctory. You get used to it and you can just go through the motions because it becomes habitual then. But our efforts now aren't to be caught up in the momentum of habits that we're, and not to develop new habits, but to use conventions to develop, to sustain awareness and to remind us of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. So for lay people, you have to figure this out in your own living situation, considering the people you're living with, and that'd be fine, you know, some. If your partner is not interested in meditation, or there's all kinds of conflicts around the people that we live with and that we work with, because meditation is oftentimes seen as a threat. People see it as something that's going to, you know, you're going to change and be different, and you're not going to be the one who, you know, you're used to, and who will go along with and do all the things that you're used to doing. So we have to take that into account, how to live and sustain our practice within the conditions that we have. And so recognize that this is an ideal condition, you know, where it's directed, it's focused, it's supportive in every way. So this is, you know, this is one of the best. And so you reflect that when things are at their best, but you can't live like, there's not even monks and nuns can live on in such a way. As an ongoing practice is an extreme. So the same monastic life is around the ordinariness of monastic daily life rather than a very special meditation retreat situation. So this is the Divinaya discipline of the monk and the monastic routine, the life, the daily life, is supportive towards mindfulness. And of course, we are living in a community where everybody is kind of supporting each other as best we can toward this. So that is very good. But in, say, the world, maybe this is not possible. But then you can take that into account. Don't see it as an obstruction that means you can't practice, but it means that it's something you have to take into account in your practice, to bring into consciousness the kind of situation you're in, the people you're living with, the responsibilities that you have, a professional situation you're in, and all the contributing factors to the experience of daily life, so that you're not to criticize or complain, but to just accept and notice that these things one can be aware of, can actually use. In monastic communities, as much as we're all kind of dedicated to the same goal and have the same aspiration, but yet there's a lot of suffering around personal conflicts. It's always quite, you know, when you contemplate the quality of people that enter the monastic life, and they, you know, it's like cream of the crop, really. People are very morally responsible and committed and in every way to a spiritual goal, willing to give up all worldly pleasures, renounce, be celibate, and live in a restrained and give up personal freedom to just do and go and say what you want. And so there's a high level of personal commitment and responsibility, and yet in a monastery there's a lot of suffering around personality conflicts. So really good people, spiritually developed and aspiring people also oftentimes cannot get along with each other very well. So don't think that this is just the lay person's problem. But then that's part of life, isn't it? When we're contemplating the world, not a complaint, but that's part of our experience. The different ways we just move or look or the position we're in, or the kind of way we, whether we're born under what star sign, or whether we're from what generation, or from what cultural background, or class, or race, or gender, and all these things do, are causes of misunderstanding. It's easy if they just say like Americans and English people to totally misunderstand each other, separated by a common language, I think it's called. They were of very good intention and very, very committed to the same thing, but oftentimes really misunderstanding the way we talk, or the assumptions we're making are different. And so even on that, then there's like the different, say from Asian countries, we have Sri Lankans and Thais and Cambodians, and we have different European nationalities and Australian, New Zealanders and all like that. Living under the same discipline, the same aspiration, and yet there can be really a lot of angst and anguish or rage over just because the expectation of the assumptions we're making are quite different. Or then around the gender of the body, the nuns, they, and the monks. A lot of really misunderstandings between male and female, because they're very different in how they think and react to life. You may have noticed. Or different age groups, the fact that different generations, like my generation, I'm living in a community of people who are all considerably younger than I am. So, sometimes I find the kind of, I kind of get bewildered by certain things, because I've been a monk for over 30 years, and they talk about all these things that have happened between 1960 and 1997. I don't know what they're talking about at the time. But these things needn't be problems. In terms of to be taken into account. That's why we're looking at the mind rather than trying to solve all these things and try to get perfect understanding and rapport and each culture, each, and we have to iron out all the wrinkles and all the misunderstandings between them. Men and women, and between different generations, different cultures, ethnic backgrounds, personalities, star signs, and so forth. And it's like, I want to go off to my cave. I want to be alone. Leave me alone. I can't bear it. It's too complicated. Because on that level, it's hopeless. You're trying to have perfect harmony and understanding, mutual respect, and that with between even a group of people, say in a monastery like this, that are all extremely fine people in themselves, same aspirations, same commitment. So you have to work in a different level on that. That's what meditation is, getting to the realization of truth that is beyond transcending all these different things that affect this our lives, our daily lives. This is where we also develop a lot of wisdom because of this. I think if we live in a cave, we probably don't develop much wisdom. Maybe we develop the wisdom that's necessary to live in a cave. But when you get outside of that, you probably don't know what to do. So I remember in early years in Thailand, I'd have to sometimes, and be living in the forests in the northeast, and then I have to go to Bangkok for something. And the idea was, Bangkok was a terrible place that you couldn't practice. It ruined your samadhi. It was noisy and dirty and too many distractions. And so the common assumption among Western monks anyway was that you tried to avoid going to Bangkok at all costs, only for necessary things, if you had to, then you go and you get back to your cave as quickly as possible. And the attitude was Bangkok was, like a place you can't be mindful in, you can't practice. So I contemplated that. I thought, what is mindfulness if it's dependent upon a situation? If you can only be mindful in a cave or in a forest, that doesn't seem like mindfulness to me. That seems like you're getting dependent upon a place. That you're assuming that in order for you to get enlightened, you have to depend on a place, and so that you can get all the right thing, control all the right things, and then hopefully get what you want from that. So just noticing that assumption, that the idea that Bangkok is, you can't practice in Bangkok, I began to see that was just an opinion that seemed true. I mean, it seemed at the time, that was the way it is, that Bangkok was difficult and noisy and all that's true, but one can still be mindful in Bangkok. And so changing the attitude towards, rather than just grasping the idea, the bias against Bangkok, letting go of that one, and just learning to use the situation that one is in. If you're in Bangkok, then this is where you're mindful, or wherever you are, you can be mindful of that. So because of that, I never found Bangkok an obstruction to practice, or that my practice somehow diminished and became worse in Bangkok. Because I was determined to use the experience there for with mindfulness and with wisdom. That doesn't mean I've never liked living there. I don't like living in big cities anyway. So it isn't a wanting to live there, I would naturally gravitate to the more rural places, the forests, when that's possible, but not to make assumptions or attachments, so that the life, the meditation is more of a flowing situation rather than a fixed one. In daily life, you bring into your mind the situation you're in, and then see what you can do with it. Like just they say, formal practice. How can you say practice? Do formal meditation practice in daily life. How can you integrate that into your daily routine or responsibilities or family life? That's something you have to figure out for yourself. How to do that, knowing the situation you're in. But it's very good to use formal practice as just like an exercise, or do anapanasati, mindfulness of the breath, or relaxation exercises, or the sound of silence help to always establish, bring you back into even though your mind may be wandering all over the place, to compose yourself at times during the day. So I found that one can do formal sittings, and maybe you can only do it 15 minutes in the morning or whatever. It's still better than not doing it. Even if it's only 5 minutes, it's still better to, or even it's better to think, even 1 minute's better than not bothering. Or even thinking the idea I should meditate. But to establish the morning and evening practice that is, not disrupting your family life or being inconsiderate and rude to the family or the people you're living with, but which you feel is right and suitable. That's for something that you have to figure out. Also, with the sound of silence, I found that very useful as a way of integrating practice, because in traffic jam, like in Bangkok, where they have these terrible traffic jams, people complain about it all the time. Traffic jams, and yet one can practice meditation very well in traffic jam. If you're stuck in a traffic jam for half an hour, you've got half an hour's anapanasati, and sound of silence, or watch the irritation or the mental agitation you create around this anticipating or this kind of this restless feeling of wanting to get somewhere and not be stuck. Or you can use the situation for developing awareness around what you're feeling. I have found in a traffic jam the mind is always wanting to, you feel this desire to move, and you feel this kind of irritation, frustration at not being able to move. And then the traffic starts moving a bit, and you kind of, now we're going, and then it stops again. So you can observe this, be the observer of this emotional reaction to to just the experience of being stuck in a traffic jam. We can use these frustrating situations as Dhamma practice rather than being caught up in the usual grumbling or negative reactions to them that we usually produce. So this is developing wisdom, isn't it? We're now taking wisdom and using it with the experiences that we have in life. I find, you know, the sound of silence is useful to work with people in meetings. It helps to center me and to help me to kind of empty my mind out rather than just be caught in reactivity to what people say. So we've been having these kind of meetings sometimes called process meetings, where you're supposed to talk about how you feel and things like that with each other. And so you feel this sense of vulnerability when you're talking about how you feel in a group. Because we, you know, my generation, we never talked about how we felt in a group, and so this is quite a new idea, new experience. But I observed the feelings of nervousness whenever these meetings come around, and kind of you get the kind of butterflies feeling, the things start kind of. Nervous sensations in your guts, an idea of having to talk about personal feeling in a group that the group of monks brings up these feelings. Not because it's the fault of the monks or even myself, but this is just what I'm noticing, being aware of how things affect this body and this being when these kind of conditions exist. Or when people criticize, people in the past several years have been quite critical of me, so that I've had to use that as a means of practice to be able to notice the effect of, you know, the emotional reaction and physical reaction to, say, what they call sharing. They say, let me share something with you, I don't know. But in some ways it's very good to do that, because, you know, it helps to bring into consciousness of a lot of fear and feelings of being threatened and being or misunderstood, all these kind of emotions. Feeling one is being treated unfairly or criticized unfairly. So that the aim is to be able to recognize these emotional reactions in terms of Dhamma. They arise and they cease. And when it's getting into personal things, the emotions get increasingly more kind of real. Powerful. And when it's about something else, when we have business meetings and talking about things like that, it somehow they, it's not so strong. But when you're getting into personal things, then it brings up a lot of fear and of being rejected or being exposed or being humiliated in some way or being put down. Well, these are part of human experience in the world, so that this also can be seen in terms of Dhamma. So I find with emotional, personal emotional problems, things, I do try to focus on the feelings in the body, the trunk of the body. So just to be able to sustain attention on the actual feeling that I'm having, the physical feeling. Like if somebody is saying something I don't like, I don't want to hear, or I don't agree with, and then I could either argue back or, you know, walk out of the room or just shut down, refuse to listen, or I can look at, you know, listen and pay attention to the feelings in the body. So I found this very strengthening ability to say listen, to be able to keep my attention on the feelings I hear. Somebody's criticizing me, and then I'm listening, the sound of silence, and I'm sustaining and I'm concentrating on the feelings, the tensions in the down in here usually. When you're being criticized, I usually feel it down here. So I by practicing with that, then I find that I'm not getting, if I use bodily feeling, then that stops, and the sound of silence, I can stop the thinking process. And then that lingering emotion that hangs around in the physical sensations, as you embrace those, accept those, then they'll change and they'll cease. And that's a very wonderful way for developing a lot of strength in being able to listen to other people, to reflect and try to understand what people are saying, or trying to even understand yourself better, rather than just be caught in reactivity and controlling and manipulating a scene to protect yourself. So in terms of what we've been doing these 2 weeks, it integrates well into a very stressful situation also. But it does take wisdom and the willingness to use the experiences of life. With the self, oftentimes we've got a lot of pride and a lot of fear to deal with. So that sometimes one doesn't want to hear, one just wants to, you know, go off to the cave, and leave me alone reaction, which I, you know, can fully appreciate and understand. But also there's this other way of dealing with it, which I find a very strengthening approach. It makes me unafraid of life. Before, I had a lot of fear around life, you know, and when I was a lay person, I was a very controlling kind of person. I got myself through university and all kinds of situations because I could manipulate and control things for my own benefits, and a kind of survivalist mind. And so I could, in the system I lived in, I could, you know, I learned how to operate and protect myself. But I also had a lot of self-aversion because of that, self-loathing, and also a lot of fear and inability to listen to people or try to just react. I'd just be very reactive and defensive towards other people. Well, it makes it impossible for anyone to live. You can't live with anyone like that very long or very well. So I was married 2 years. Wife couldn't stand it anymore. So the these are the kind of, because there are a lot of fear. If things got into a place where one was being threatened, then I could get very very fierce and rage would take over and be very frightening. So this is neurotic, yes, but it's also a result of having not understanding things and not knowing how to deal with stressful situations, or how to develop a relationship with somebody else. It was more or less based on ideals, like romantic ideals. The marriage was kind of a romantic ideal. I liked the idea of it and the romantic part of it. I mean, you can't, you know, that's to sustain that as an ongoing way of relating to each other is impossible. And then you get down to the practicalities of being with each other and irritating each other and misunderstanding each other and threatening and criticizing and resenting and hating and loving and fearing and so forth that we have in regards to people that we share our lives with. So this kind of practice also helps to deal with those kind of problems. The fact that because I've developed this practice, then those kind of situations don't frighten me anymore. I'm quite open and willing to walk into the lion's den. Or try to get through the snake pit, or the yeah, I've been married for 31 years now. I think we marry the Dhamma, which is I'm quite happy with. It's been a good. It's been a good marriage. So this sense of fearlessness comes from understanding the Dhamma, or the way things are, understanding yourself. And through understanding yourself also, you understand the problems of others, and then much more compassion and gentleness and kindness come from that understanding. So in meditation practice, don't see it as just a sitting on a zafu, shutting everyone out, but see how to develop it into an awareness. Because with this sound of silence, it gives you a kind of expansive container in which your own gut feelings and the people that are impinging on. You can be, you know, in that moment it all fits together, and you can use that situation rather than run away to a cave and where you can get one-pointed concentration on an object. This is intuitive awareness, where you remember intuition is whole. It takes on everything, so it embraces. It takes like this. It's like this. So that right now there's the sound of silence. I can be aware of the body as it is, the breath, the mood of the mind. I can listen to somebody, or I'm aware of some things around me that affect me. And through this kind of intuition, I've also just observed how much just natural reactivity there is, just body language, how it affects, how somebody moves or looks or that, of how it affects your conscious experience. And just aggressive gestures or angry looks, or you feel it, don't you? Walk, you know, sometimes you meet somebody and they give you a really mean look and you feel it. Maybe then you tend to take it personally, like, think, what did I do? What have I done now? Find out that they're not angry at you, they're angry at somebody else. Or maybe they're not angry, maybe they're just in a bad mood, or they, maybe that's how they look when they're not smiling. Or maybe they're angry at me. But it is just, or the way somebody walks or moves, it, you know, as you're in the state of awareness, intuitive awareness, you're aware of how just bodily gestures affect consciousness. Like, you can find yourself kind of being startled by just the way somebody walks toward you, or the kind of vibrations they send to you. The sensitivity is including that, but rather than interpreting in through fear and desire and personal explanations, you're contemplating it in terms of Dhamma. So you're in that way, in that willingness to do so, you're getting beyond just the because the fear is always around, is very personal, you know. The anxiety, the despair, the indignation come usually related to some form of conceit or fear on a personal level. Like, none of us like to be humiliated or made to look like a fool in public. So you find that, but sometimes it's happened. This is something to, and it's a kind of pride, isn't it? Conceit, wanting to appear good all the time and not look foolish, not to be made fun of. But still, when those things happen, we see that as an opportunity rather than be caught up in the anger or be carried away by the emotional reaction. Just like what I was telling you the other day about being a Buddhist monk when I first came to live in London, and people would make fun of me on the street and call me skinhead and Hare Krishna and other names that I will not repeat. Group of polite and refined people. Hare Krishna and skinhead are politer versions. But I'd try to get some feeling, you know, begin to look at what I, that sense of being threatened, or that, and that resentment that comes from being made fun of. So instead of wallowing in or suppressing, but using that, to get in touch with that kind of emotional reaction helps a lot to give you a confidence and strength, strengthens you in your life as a member of this society. So these are really valuable tools which I hope you don't think are just, you can only use at Amaravati retreats. this is like the practice ground, the training course. The real practice is in the daily life. So I offer this as a reflection for this evening.
Antapayang kamakatha sathukharang tathamase
Sathukharang tathamase.